From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the April 2020 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Invasion Norway. In early 1940, as winter turned to spring, the world waited for the phony war to end with the expected German attack in the west. But the leaders of both Allied and Axis forces were looking in another direction, to the north, to the snow and the steel, to Scandinavia. Meanwhile, in a wooden hut at Bletchley Park, recent recruit Harry Hinsley was certain a German fleet was preparing to set sail. But how could he, a 21-year-old civilian in a highly secret department, persuade the Admiralty that he was right? In this It Happened Here episode, we explore the difficult start of Bletchley Park's role in Britain's war at sea. Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, will be our guide. As usual, special thanks go to Mr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
In our last episode, we looked at the early breaks of Enigma and particularly the Army and the Air Force. In this episode, we'll be looking at the Navy and the role of intelligence on the campaign in early 1940. Our title is Invasion Norway. David, what was the significance of Norway to Britain and to Germany?
Well, Norway has particular significance to both powers, even though it was neutral and wasn't part of the war at that point. From the German point of view, they are reliant on iron ore imports from Sweden. But the problem with bringing iron ore from Sweden is the Baltic Sea, which is the most direct route from Sweden to Germany, is frozen for half the year. So during the winter, they would put the iron ore on trains and send it from Sweden through Norway to Narvik, which is on the northern Norwegian coast, and then it would travel from there by ship to Germany. So Norway is of vital strategic interest to the Germans. Also, thinking about the Battle of the Atlantic that has already begun, the Norwegian coast is a great place to base both U-boats and surface ships, so it would help the Germans as well to have access to the coast. On the British side, basically, the British interest is to stop the Germans doing that, so the Admiralty already had plans afoot to potentially occupy Narvik and prevent the flow of iron ore from there. Also, if Britain could have bases on the Norwegian coast, that would help shut the North Sea to German ships and submarines trying to get out into the Atlantic. So both sides have a really strong interest in what happens in Norway. But the problem they both have is neither of them wants to be seen as the aggressor in this situation. So there's a kind of a standoff where they're both waiting for the other side to move to give them an excuse to get involved. And in fact, they're both kind of hoping that the other side will move.
Were they both idle at this point, waiting for someone to twitch? Or were there actions happening, but just nothing that would be potentially the prompt for this larger kind of conflict that would then maybe cause a sort of an escalation in Norway?
Well, both sides have plans afoot to occupy Norway, either in whole or in part. The Germans have been thinking about this since October 1939. The British also come up with several plans. One plan that Churchill came up with was a thing called Operation Wilfred. And when the iron ore was travelling down the Norwegian coast, one of the features of that coast is, as we all know, it's full of fjords and islands, and it's a very kind of complicated area. And it's possible to sail down the coast of Norway, hugging the shoreline and hiding behind all the islands. And Churchill thought that if you could mine those inner leads, as they're called, you would force the German merchant ships to go further out into the North Sea in order to sail south. And obviously, if they're further out in the sea, they're easier to sink. So there was this plan that they would mine those channels. And they'd also come up with a second plan, which was potentially to secure Narvik itself with ground troops, to actually land a sort of mini invasion there. And that was partly based on the fact that at this point, the Finns were fighting the Soviets, who, of course, at this point, since the Ribbentrop Pact, are allied to the Germans. So there was a vague suggestion that Britain might support the Finns across the top of Norway. But actually, in the event, the Finns lost the war before that became relevant, so the Finnish part of the equation drops out. But the British still have these kind of plans in reserve for what to do about Norway. And Churchill, typically for Churchill, is quite keen to act on these plans. But other people are saying, you know, no, wait, we need to see what the Germans are going to do first.
Did anything happen to provoke that activity then? Did either side twitch?
Well, there was a sort of a heightening of tension because the German battleship Graf Spee that had been sailing round the South Atlantic is famously damaged in the Battle of the River Plate at the end of 1939 and ultimately scuttled in Montevideo. But in the process of sinking British merchant ships in the South Atlantic, it had been loading the crews of those merchant ships onto a German ship called the Altmark. And the Altmark was sailing back to Germany with all these prisoners of war on board. And it sailed into Norwegian waters on its way to Germany. And in a rather famous incident at the time, the Royal Navy's HMS Cossack, a destroyer, sailed after it, boarded the German ship, captured it, and freed all the prisoners. This was a big news story in the UK at the time because there was very little good news around. And the story of the boarding of the Altmark became a big sort of media event. The problem was that both sides were in the wrong because the Germans, under international law, should have docked the Altmark and unloaded the prisoners to neutral Norway, which they hadn't done. But equally, Britain, by attacking the Altmark within Norwegian territorial waters, was breaking international law as well. So actually, both sides were kind of in the wrong, but equally, both sides made a big deal of it from a publicity point of view to suggest that the other side was being unnecessarily belligerent or breaking the rules. And all this does, of course, is it just heightens the tension around the Norwegian situation altogether.
And this was February 1940, is that right?
Yes, yes.
Is the action off the plate, there has recently been added an epilogue. The rescue last week by the Cossack and her flotilla under the nose of the enemy and amid the tangles of one-sided neutrality. The rescue of British captives taken from the sunken German raider, your friend, the one you sunk, their rescue at the very moment when these unhappy men were about to be delivered over to indefinite German bondage proves that the long arm of British sea power can be stretched out not only for foes, but also for faithful friends. And to Nelson's immortal signal of 135 years ago, England expects that every man will do his duty. There may now be added last week's not less proud reply, the Navy is here.
Can you tell us what was the German plan?
Well, the Germans had been keen to invade Norway almost straight away when the war broke out. So as early as October, Admiral Raeder, who's the commander of the German Navy at that period, he can see all these advantages there would be to the German Navy of being able to use Norway. So he starts arguing with Hitler in October 39 that they should basically attack Norway in some form. Hitler isn't persuaded of this until December, but at that point he starts getting word from Norway that the British are potentially going to invade. And the person in Norway who has Hitler's ear is Vidkun Quisling, who's a pro-German Norwegian politician who's become rather notorious in Second World War history. He was very keen for the Germans to get involved in Norway, so he was telling all these stories to Hitler that they were under threat from the British.
Could I check his surname, Quisling? That's actually used to describe traitors or collaborators or something, isn't it?
Yes, it's become a term in its own right. Yes, we talk about Quislings being as you say, collaborators or traitors. And his name has literally become a byword for that. He briefly became leader of Norway under the German administration. So yes, anyway, he's on the side of the Germans and he's busy sending messages going, oh, you've got to come here quick because the British will beat you to it. So in January of 1940, the German Navy starts operational planning for an attack on Norway. But the difficulty they have is the German Army and the German Air Force, their main focus is on France and the Low Countries. And they've already got troops positioned there during the Phony War, as it's called. Both sides are kind of staring at each other across the frontier in France and Belgium. And so they're not particularly keen to be distracted by an operation in the north. And what this means is the Norwegian project becomes a German naval-led project, even though land forces are included. By the end of January, Raeder and his team have come up with a plan, and it gets the operational name Operation Weserübung, which is named after the River Weser in Germany. And partly because of the amount of army cooperation he's getting, Raeder's come up with a plan that uses relatively small numbers of German troops. The plan is to use only 6 divisions of troops. And if you consider a single division is probably 10,000 to 15,000 men. To invade a whole country, this is a very, very small force. But his theory is if those troops can be put on German naval ships rather than merchant ships, or at least the first wave can, then they can make their way to Norway very, very quickly. And the idea is to land not just in the south, where, you know, around Oslo, where it might be expected, but to drop troops in all of the ports up the coast, right up as far as Narvik, in one hit. And by doing that, kind of overwhelm all the country's communications and its principal ports very, very quickly. And the idea of that is that the blow will land so fast that firstly, the British won't be able to do anything about it, and neither will the Norwegians, and it'll be kind of all over before anybody's really realised what's happening.
If the plan was to send the troops on German naval ships and they're going to be putting in at ports all the way along the enormous coast of Norway, does that mean the German Navy was quite large, quite strong at this point?
Rather the opposite, in fact. The German Navy, this stretches its resources, certainly in warships, to the limit because the German surface navy is never very large. The problem Raeder had was that when they began their building program to try and compete with the UK, which they did in the late 1930s, that plan wasn't going to be completed until later in the 1940s. So when the war started in 1939, a lot of the ships he was going to rely on to fight the Royal Navy weren't even built yet. So at this point, there are a number of battle cruisers, heavy cruisers, and sort of medium-sized warships, I suppose. But the really famous ships that everyone's heard of, things like the Bismarck, the Tirpitz, they're not complete yet. They're still being constructed at this point. So the Germans really have to use all of the ships they have available. And one of the ironies of the campaign is, although the attack is successful, the German Navy takes such losses in the course of this campaign that it really blunts the effectiveness of their surface fleet for the rest of the war. And even though these other ships, the more famous ones, do eventually get built, you can't just send a large battleship to sea on its own. It needs an escort of destroyers, for example, or smaller cruisers. And the Norway campaign costs the Kriegsmarine so many destroyers that it really hampers what they do later in the war.
I suppose by committing such a large proportion of their forces, though, that shows the importance that they held this activity in. The payoff would have been controlling Norway and therefore controlling the North Sea, effectively.
It would be, absolutely, yes. And part of the idea of doing it very quickly is they are painfully aware that the Royal Navy's home fleet is up there in Scapa Flow. And if that fully mobilises and sails into the North Sea, they can't fight Jutland over again, the famous battle from the First World War. If the Royal Navy properly gets involved, they are going to lose because the German force is much, much smaller. But they're hoping by being sneaky and by being quick that they can get the job done and get their ships out of danger before the Royal Navy can intervene. And again, if they do that, because they've been building up all these years with Britain as their principal opponent, it will be quite a propaganda coup for them, if you like. If they can say, we sneaked in under the noses of the home fleet and did this and got away with it, then that'll look really good.
Scharnhorst sollst du heißen, zum ehrenden Gedächtnis jenes Sohnes deiner niedersächsischen Heimat, der in Zeiten des tiefsten Niederganges unbeirrbar für eine bessere Zukunft seines Vaterlandes strebte und kämpfte. Und so taufe ich dich auf den Namen Scharnhorst.
You mentioned the British and the Royal Navy. Did the British have any intentions towards Norway as well, in a similar way to what the Germans were planning?
Well, they did have a landing operation planned out. As I was saying earlier, this idea that they might intervene around Narvik to prevent the iron ore exports, even if Germany didn't attack. But their plan also had in mind that they might need to respond to a German attack. The problem was that there's not very much clear thinking. They have a plan to move troops to Norway, but also the home fleet kind of has a separate plan to sally forth to attack the German Navy. And the two plans don't really mesh together very well, because the ships that were allocated to escort the land force across the North Sea were also allocated to escort the battleships of the main fleet. So they were kind of caught between two stools about what they were actually going to do.
If the British did have a plan, as you say, that must have been based on some knowledge of what the Germans were planning. Did the British know about the German plans in advance?
Well, yes and no. One of the difficulties of the 1939-1940 period is that British intelligence generally, and I'm not just talking about Bletchley Park here, I'm talking about the whole world of SIS and all the other intelligence sources that are available, that really isn't a joined-up operation at the start of the war. And so you have a number of sources coming forward with information about what the Germans might be planning, but that information doesn't make its way through to the decision-makers particularly effectively. SIS, in particular, the Secret Intelligence Service, doesn't have a particularly good agent network in Europe at the beginning of the war. They do have some people who are providing information. I mean, what's quite striking is there's a man called Förster, who is a German in local government. He's the Gauleiter of Danzig, and he's actually reporting to the Foreign Office. So they do have some quite senior spies in Germany. They also have contacts in Sweden and in Norway itself, and stuff is filtering through from all these people. But the problem is, it's hints and tips. It's secondhand messages from somebody who said something to somebody else, you know. So it isn't given much credence by the powers that be in Britain. And what they're waiting for, if you like, is the joined up picture. It's all very well getting a rumor from SIS that the Germans are planning something, but then that needs to be supported by concrete information. So evidence that ships are being prepared in ports or signals intelligence or whatever. And the problem is that they're not really getting any of the latter. The aerial reconnaissance effort against the German ports in northern Germany doesn't really get going till February or March of 1940. And so, you know, photographing harbours to see how many ships are there or whether the battleships have left or whatever is very important. And it's not really happening. And even where it is happening, it's not being joined up with the other data that's available. You have these really weird situations that in military intelligence at the War Office, there's one team in MI3 who deal with Germany, and there's a different team in MI2 who deal with Scandinavia, and they're not necessarily talking to each other. So there's not nearly enough joined up thinking going on. And even when this intelligence does make it to the powers that be, the Chief of Staff's Committee, who are the people who decide British strategy, have their own preconceived ideas about what a German invasion would look like. And they make the estimate, which is not unreasonable, that if you were going to invade Norway, and they think they'd probably invade Sweden as well, if you're going to invade Scandinavia, you probably need 20 to 30 divisions of troops. And the only evidence they had was that the number of divisions involved was in single figures. You know, it was four or five divisions. Their reaction to that was, well, that's clearly not enough to do the job, so we don't believe they're going to try it. History shows, and we just mentioned earlier, that actually the German operation was planned very, very lean on ground troops, and they indeed only used six divisions for the attack initially. So even had the Chief of Staff's Committee seen the German plan in a lot of detail, they still probably wouldn't have believed it.
You say there's information coming through to SIS, but it sounds as if a lot of it is sort of, I don't know, almost rumour or hearsay or passed by word of mouth. Would that be right?
Yes, very much so, yes. And it's coming from, in some cases, not at first hand. For example, the Swedes are reporting information that their intelligence services may be picking up in Germany, but the Foreign Office or SIS are not talking directly to the sources for some of this stuff. So it's even more shady, if you like, and uncertain. And again, the different people collecting it are not sharing it with other people who are collecting other things. So that's a big part of the problem.
It's funny, this lack of communication or disorganization sounds quite familiar to me. It sounds like we've talked about in previous podcasts about the warring departments in Germany not communicating effectively, and that that was one of their major downsides of the German intelligence structure. It sounds as if that's an issue on the British side as well in the early war.
It was to a certain extent. I mean, one of the differences between the two sides is that the Allies managed to get themselves organised in a way that the Axis powers never do. So while they're both floundering around a bit at the beginning of the war, it's fortunate for the Allies that they get organised a lot more quickly. But the other problem you have isn't just about the quality of the intelligence itself. One of the jobs of strategic planners and senior analysts is to decide what it's likely that the enemy will do. And one of the problems was that the British government thought it had a very good idea of what the Germans would do. And so when intelligence came in that contradicted with their own interpretation of what they were going to do, they didn't necessarily believe it. Winston Churchill, for example, didn't think that the German army was strong enough to invade Norway. He was convinced that all of their troops were facing France and the Low Countries and that they simply didn't have the capability. So when somebody came along saying, you know, they're about to invade Norway, because it went against his preconceived idea of their strategy, he wasn't so keen on it. Equally, the Admiralty, they were kind of obsessed with the Atlantic. And if the German fleet was massing and manoeuvring, then their immediate reaction was that must be because they're trying to head out into the Atlantic to attack Atlantic convoys. They didn't necessarily think it was part of a plan to invade Norway. And again, that reflects their own strategic interpretation and their own fears, rather than properly putting themselves in the position of the Germans and understanding what it is they're trying to do.
Did they not have much signals intelligence? I mean, we always talk about intercepted messages and the intelligence can be gleaned from that, whether that's encrypted with Enigma, which is obviously at its early stage of being deciphered at this point. But was there not messages being intercepted that gave some idea of what was happening here?
One of the problems with understanding the German Navy at this period is, although we've talked previously in the podcast about breaking of German Army and Air Force Enigma, German Navy Enigma resisted Bletchley's breaking efforts until 1941, mostly. So German naval traffic is being picked up, but all they know is that messages are being sent. They can't read the messages. So it's relatively difficult to infer a lot of detail from that. One example of the British misunderstanding of German intentions is that in March, the German Air Force attacked the Royal Naval Air Station, as it's called, at Hatstone on Orkney. From the Navy's point of view, Hatstone is right up near Scapa Flow, where the Home Fleet was based. So they interpreted that as this is the Germans thinking about attacking the Home Fleet. What they didn't appreciate was Hatstone is actually one of the few airfields in the UK that is within operational range of Norway. So the reason they were attacking it was to try and knock it out so they couldn't intervene with their operations in Norway. But the same event, the bombing of Hatstone, could be interpreted completely differently by the Royal Navy. And that's, in fact, what they did. They looked at it in a completely different strategic context and failed to understand its significance.
To all the vital points of the world, from Scapa to Cape Town, the British Navy, the greatest in the world, is the guarantee of freedom. Thousand ships, motor torpedo boats, planes of the Coastal Command, operating with seagoing aircraft carriers, destroyers. They combine speed with fierce striking power. Cruisers, light and heavy. They have earned themselves a fine reputation in the present war. Ships like these defeated the Graf Spee.
Can you tell us what the role of Bletchley Park, GCNCS, was in all of this?
Well, Bletchley, as I was saying, have been listening to German naval communications since the start of the war. But the problem they have is that unlike German Army or German Air Force, who use a variety of codes as well as Enigma, and they only use Enigma at quite a high level. The German Navy communicated almost exclusively using Enigma, so about 90% of their communications are done with it, and almost every German warship of any size has an Enigma machine. So what that meant is almost all of that traffic is unreadable by Bletchley. And the only thing they can do is traffic analysis, which is basically noticing who is talking to whom, looking at call signs where possible, even though they were also encrypted, and trying to guess on the basis of sometimes as little as just changes in the traffic volume, just how many messages are being sent and potentially how many messages are being sent from one person to another person. Trying to infer from that the strategic picture.
So if there's a larger quantity of messages.
Yes, if the message is sort of burbling along at a certain level and then suddenly you get a loss of messages sent to one place, then that might give you a clue that that place has become important and that something's about to happen. Unfortunately, it doesn't tell you what that thing is. You just have to kind of work from there. And the result of this is that through the back end of 1939 and into 1940, Bletchley provides almost no useful information to the Admiralty in terms of sort of operational intelligence. They are able to build up a picture of the German fleet in the kind of long-term sense of, you know, how many ships they've got. But in terms of being able to identify movements of ships or starts of operations in time to actually do anything about them, Bletchley's not really doing that at this point. And it's notable that the famous sea battle from 1939 is the sinking of the Graf Spee and the Battle of the River Plate. And actually, Bletchley was never able to glean any useful information about what the Graf Spee was doing until she was found by patrolling ships and ultimately identified in Montevideo. So for most of the campaign, and including the battle, the Royal Navy didn't know which German ship it was. They thought it was a different one. So that shows how little they're able to get from SIGINT at that period. Things change because in January, they start to break German Army and German Air Force enigma. And some of that does discuss matters that relate to the Navy. And some of it potentially will discuss preparations for the invasion of Norway. But it's far less than you'd want in an ideal situation.
Were the Navy using any other encryption systems, or were they heavily reliant? You said that 90% was Enigma. Were they getting anything from the other 10%, or was that also a bit of a non-starter at Bletchley?
It's a bit of a non-starter. They're getting a little bit, but as I say, they're not getting enough for it to be terribly useful. And also they have the problem that they're not really producing intelligence in real time at this point. Any code breaking they do takes so long that you're talking days later in terms of getting a useful response for it. So you might be able to read messages that tell you what happened 2 weeks ago, but reading messages that tell you what's going to happen in the next 2 weeks is much more difficult.
Was the team at Bletchley Park set up, though? In our previous podcast, Enigma Unlocked, we were talking about the massive effort at Bletchley to break Enigma. It wasn't as if they were sitting there wondering how they could do it. There was a real effort. Was that the same on the naval side? Was there a really large team working towards this? Or was the lack of any progress shown in sort of the staff numbers or the work that they were doing?
They were trying very hard. And if you look at the balance in naval section in 1939, the majority of people in naval section are dealing with Italian traffic, because pre-war, the Italian Navy was considered to be the big threat. But if you look at the evolution of naval section from September 39 onwards, the German section grows pretty rapidly. And so they're getting people in place in the hope that they will start to make some progress. And Turing has one eye on Naval Enigma and indeed goes on to lead Hut 8 and to make a direct attack on Naval Enigma. It's just that that process takes time. And in the meanwhile, they're left with what they can do, which is basic traffic analysis and looking for whatever hints and tips they can find.
You say that Turing and his team were working on Naval Enigma at this point. Are there any other people, any other names that we might recognise who are also working on it?
Well, one of the very famous people who's involved in the story at this point is Harry Hinsley, who went on to be a very big figure in Naval Section. His job when he joined Naval Section in 1939 was to do this very basic traffic analysis, and he was one of the early figures. We're very fortunate with Harry Hinsley because he was a codebreaker at Bletchley Park, but also after the war he went on to be the official historian and wrote the official history of British intelligence after the war. He went on to be a Cambridge academic and a very significant historian. And after his death, his archive, or a substantial portion of it, was donated to us at Bletchley Park. So we have all sorts of interesting bits and pieces connected with his life. Many of the Bletchley Park codebreakers came from Oxford and Cambridge in the early part of the Second World War. And Hinsley was one of those. But we tend to think of them as, well, as posh boys because they went to Cambridge or Oxford. But actually, Hinsley's background is quite modest. He came from Walsall, where his father worked for the coal department and his mother was a caretaker in a school. But as an example of the social mobility of the 1930s, he went to grammar school in Walsall, and then in 1937, he won a scholarship to go to St. John's College, Cambridge. So in 1939, he'd just finished his second year at Cambridge studying history, and he was about to go into his third year. He decided to spend his summer in Germany, in fact. He had a girlfriend in Koblenz, and he travelled over there in August of 1939. And obviously, tension was quite high at the time. And initially, he had to report to the local police station every morning as a sort of alien in the country. But then later in August, you have the signing of the Ribbentrop Pact with the USSR. And at least from the German perspective, they thought that the tension had declined a bit. So the police said to him, it's all right, you don't have to come and report every day. So he was living quite happily with his girlfriend and her family. When on 1st of September, a message came from the police station saying, Herr Hinsley, you need to go home straight away because Poland was getting invaded and tensions are suddenly ratcheted right back up again. So he had to up sticks and get out of Germany more or less as fast as he could. He was interviewed about this by St. John's College in the late 90s, and he tells a story of how he crossed into France at Strasbourg as a bridge that formed the border. And in the process of going through German customs, they confiscated all of his German money and didn't give him any French or English money in exchange for it. So he crossed the bridge completely penniless and described how he had to sleep on a park bench in Strasbourg overnight and then hitchhike to Switzerland. But once he got to Switzerland, he was able to get in touch with authorities and make his way back to Britain. So he narrowly avoided being interned in Germany before the war ever started.
Wow. How did he end up at Bletchley Park then?
Well, after his lucky escape getting out of Germany, it was, of course, term time. So he went back to Cambridge to carry on with his degree. But like many undergraduates at the time, he was at Cambridge thinking, you know, what am I doing at Cambridge when there's a war on? And he was spotted by his tutor, Martin Charlesworth, who was president of his college. And Charlesworth was part of Denniston's recruitment network for Bletchley Park. Denniston had identified a number of people in Oxford and Cambridge before the war who would act as sort of talent scouts for him. And if they had anybody in their colleges who they thought would make good GCNCS employees, then these people would be approached. So Charlesworth invited Harry Hinsley for an interview with him and Denniston, but Hinsley had no idea who Denniston was. They just sort of suggested rather obliquely that there was a job available at the Foreign Office that he might find interesting. And as we know, the rest is history. What's very nice is we actually have a letter to Harry from Charlesworth in our archive, which describes the job offer in more detail.
St. John's College, November the 17th, 1939. Dear Harry, Commander Denniston has asked me to ask you if you would be prepared to accept a job under the Foreign Office at a starting salary of £200 a year, with prospects of a rise, if you prove successful, and beginning with 1 month on probation. Your billet will cost you £1, 1 shilling a week, and your lunch 5 shillings a week. If you accept, you could join as early as is conveniently possible. Will you please write to Commander Denniston at Room 47, the Foreign Office, Whitehall, London SW1. Between you and me, I think you'll like it, and that you would be doing very useful work. If I can be of any help to you in making a decision, or giving you some more information, well, you know where to find me. All good wishes. Yours ever, Charles.
Was it his skills in the German language that got him spotted, do you think?
I don't know specifically whether it was a factor, but it certainly would have helped. Both a knowledge of German, the language, and Germany, the country, would have been definitely an asset. He was actually studying history at the time, and his work was in particular on rather obscure medieval manuscripts. So it may also have been that detailed understanding of kind of tricky documents that got him the gig as well.
And what did he do at Bletchley Park?
When he joins, he's allocated to Frank Birch's naval section, and in particular to the German subsection of naval section, which Frank Birch was running at the time. And he was put onto this traffic analysis of German naval messages. And this, at the time when he first started, was a fairly unappealing looking prospect, because although the traffic was being intercepted, very, very little was known about it. And he was one of the first people to really start making any sense of it at all. One of the first things he was able to identify is that there were two networks in operation, one covering all German naval activity in the Baltic and one covering all activity not in the Baltic. And that sounds like a fairly basic achievement, but even that starts to tell you something about what the German Navy is doing. And he went on from there building his understanding and Bletchley Park's understanding of the German Navy just from this external analysis of their messages of who was talking to whom. And what's crucial in terms of the Norway operation was that he started to see that ships that had previously been in the Baltic were moving out to German ports on the North Sea coast, and various operations were going on around there, and there was an increase in wireless activity in both areas. And if you see a sort of pattern of life, a certain level of activity, and then suddenly it spikes up and everyone starts sending messages, this is a warning that something's potentially going to happen. And Hinsley looked at this and thought, why are the German Navy's up to something? The problem was, who does he tell this to? You know, how does he pass this on? And at the time, Bletchley's naval section's chief contact in the Admiralty was an organization called the Operational Intelligence Center. And what they do is they kind of run the fight for the Navy in the basement of the Citadel, just near Horse Guards. They had a planning center where naval operations were organized. One of the problems Hinsley had was that the relationship between Bletchley Park and naval intelligence really hadn't sorted itself out at this point. There was an assumption prior to the war that Bletchley Park would basically only do literally code-breaking cryptography, and that everything else, including traffic analysis, would be done at the intelligence center at the Admiralty. And so there was a lot of tension between the two organizations about who was responsible for what and who should do what. It wasn't until after the Norwegian campaign that these things really got organized. What this meant was that when Hinsley had what he thought was significant information to report, he was passing this on to the intelligence center, and their response was, well, why are you doing that anyway? That's not really your job. The upshot is basically the Admiralty doesn't respond to his warnings. And so he was talking into thin air at that point.
There was also no adequate machinery within the departments or between them for confronting prevailing opinions and lazy assumptions with rigorous and authoritative assessments of the massive but miscellaneous information about the enemy that was nevertheless available.
Harry Hinsley, The Official History of British Intelligence in the Second World War, Volume 1.
Do you think if it had come from someone a bit more senior, it might have made a difference? Or was the division so great between GCNCS and the OIC that really they just didn't seem to understand what Bletchley Park's role was?
It's possible that somebody more senior might have had more clout. We have to remember that Hinsley was only 21 years old at the time, and he was a civilian as well. He was a Foreign Office employee, so he didn't hold any naval rank. Had it been Birch or Denniston or somebody, it might have filtered a bit further through. But again, the information he had to report looks very concrete in hindsight when we know what had happened. But to an Admiralty that was, you know, had many fish to fry at the time, these vague suggestions from somebody who was unproven at that point, or an organization that was relatively unproven at that point, would have been, you know, hard to do anything about.
It was about dawn this morning that the first reports came in saying that German troops were crossing the frontier into Denmark. At the same time, attacks were being delivered from the sea on a number of Norway's biggest ports. The Oslo radio is still working and has announced that German troops have disembarked at Egersund on the south coast of Norway, and that Kristiansand has been attacked.
Germany calling. Germany calling. Here are the Reichsender Hamburg, Station Bremen and Station DXB on the 31-meter band. You are about to hear our news in English. The Supreme Command of the German Defense Forces announces the operations to occupy Denmark and the Norwegian coast have proceeded according to plan today. On marching into and landing on Danish territory, no incidents occurred anywhere. No significant resistance was offered along the coast of Norway, except near Oslo. Resistance there was broken during the afternoon, and Oslo itself was occupied. The German minister to Norway, Dr. Breyer, received representatives of the Norwegian press today and informed them of a new appeal which he has addressed to the Norwegian government. It runs as follows. In recalling this morning's appeal, I wish once more to draw the attention of the Norwegian government to the fact that any resistance to Germany's action would be completely senseless and would only lead to an aggravation of Norway's position. I repeat that by her measures, Germany does not intend to infringe the territorial integrity or political independence of the Kingdom of Norway, either now or in the future.
You say that now we know what happened, so we have that benefit of hindsight. What actually did happen?
The Germans launched their invasion as planned by radar on 9th of April 1940, and this came as more or less a complete surprise to both the Admiralty and the French, who were involved in the operation as well, on the Allied side. So the Home Fleet up in Scapa Flow do sail when the German ships start moving prior to the actual landings on the 7th of April. But because they were still working on this preconception that German naval movements would be an attempt to break out into the Atlantic, the Home Fleet sailed in a direction to intercept such a breakout, which meant they were kind of trying to close the gap between the Orkneys and northern Norway. And at the same time, the German fleet were invading southern Norway. So the British Home Fleet is actually sailing away from the Germans at a point when they ought to be sailing towards them. Also, they embarked on Churchill's idea to mine the leads around the Norwegian coast. But the ships that were sent to do that were withdrawn a day before the Germans arrived. So while there would otherwise have been British destroyers sailing up and down the coast up near Narvik, for example, those destroyers had actually pulled out before the Germans arrived. What this gave in the northern part of Norway was a pretty clear run for the German ships to land their troops. Down south in Oslo, it was more of a fight, because to capture Oslo, you don't really have a lot of choice. It's at the top end of quite a long, thin fjord, and the Norwegians had heavily defended that fjord. There were fortresses with the equivalent of large naval guns in them. And actually, one German battlecruiser, the Blücher, was sunk trying to fight its way past those fortresses. So the Norwegians put up a pretty stiff resistance, but unfortunately, they were always really doomed to fail. And Oslo fell relatively quickly.
The transport of German troops by sea, which the Allies could impede but could not stop. The British Navy unable to control the narrow, perilous straits of the Skagerrak. Nazi Germany could reinforce the invading army by the water route, a dominant reason why the Allies were compelled to withdraw from southern Norway. Air power played a decisive part in the German success. By the sky route, they swiftly transported troops and equipment, running fleets of air transports. They seized all the good airports, fatal handicap to the Allied campaign. The Oslo flying field, airplane troops landed by the thousands. Meanwhile, air power was deadly effective on the battlefield and challenged British sea power. The seizure of a neutral nation by a sudden surprise blow secretly planned. Troops that occupied southern Norway in a swift campaign, which in motorized battle was the climax of aggression.
What was the reaction of the Allies to the German invasion?
Well, the British and the French took this as their cue to launch their land invasion of northern Norway, and expeditionary forces were sent to a number of the harbours on the northern coast. The problem was it was a really rather poorly coordinated operation. The British had very little experience of mounting these kind of operations at that period. It wasn't really something that the army and the navy had practiced to any great extent. And both the landings themselves and the campaign subsequently are a bit of a lesson in how not to fight a war. You have the problem, for example, that troops were arriving in quite confined small ports in Norway and then finding that the supplies that had been packed into their ship had been put in the wrong order. And in some cases, the thing they needed was at the bottom. And so literally the things at the top got thrown over the side into the sea so that they could get to the things at the bottom. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, they realized they needed the things at the top. So it's a bit of a shambles all around. One example of that is that hardly anybody had any maps of Norway. There were naval charts of the coast, and these were issued to aircrew in the RAF. But the problem is naval charts show the sea, but they don't show any detail of the land. So RAF pilots, in some cases, were reduced to using pre-war tourist guidebooks to find their way around, which is really no way to fight a war. The other problems were not really of the Allies' making. One of the things the Germans were able to do very quickly was establish a strong air presence in Norway. They actually used paratroops to capture some airfields. And what that meant is they had very, very good air cover for their operations. Whereas for the British, even from the tip of Scotland, Norway is at the limit of operational range of RAF aircraft at that period. And the other option was to use aircraft carriers. But in either case, it was very difficult for the Allies to impose any kind of air presence over Norway. And the one thing that the Second World War shows is if you try and fight a battle without control of the air, you're going to be in real trouble. There are some instances where they took aircraft across on aircraft carriers and then flew them off and used, for example, frozen lakes because they were flat. They used them as sort of temporary airfields. But while this worked a little bit, it was never going to be sufficient to defeat the level of air power the Germans had. And the upshot of it all is after sort of 2 months fighting, it becomes clear that the Allied Expeditionary Force is a failure. The British and French forces were essentially defeated on land. And at the beginning of June, an evacuation had to be arranged by sea from the ports of northern Norway, and all of the non-Norwegian troops were evacuated. Norwegian forces at that point had no choice but to surrender, essentially, because they didn't have the means to fight the Germans any longer. So at that point, German occupation of Norway was complete, and the Germans set up an occupation government under Quisling. One of the things that they did manage, though, was they fought long enough for the government and the royal family to evacuate. And they made their way gradually up sort of further north in Norway and ultimately were evacuated by the British at the beginning of June and set up a Norwegian government in exile in London. Informal resistance did continue because the Norwegians were obviously extremely unhappy about being invaded. One of the ironies is that Hitler considered Norway to be a really important part of his empire, and under his Aryan racial theories, he considered Norway to be very like Germany, but obviously the Norwegians took a different view from that, and they fought on as resistance and assisted the British where they could right up until the Germans were forced to surrender in 1945. Another point that's worth making about the Norwegians is that if you look at the various countries that the Germans invade in the first half of the war, the Norwegians were actually able to resist longer than either the Poles or the French, so they didn't do too bad a job of it. One of the curiosities of the campaign is the Norwegians never actually formally surrendered to the Germans because their government had continued in exile. And indeed, 5 years later, they were able to go back to Norway, the royal family and the government, and start all over again once Germany had been defeated.
Das Schlüsselfort vor Oslo, das hartnäckigen Widerstand leistet, wird von deutschen Kampfflugzeugen mit Bomben belegt.
Mit klingendem Spiel rücken die deutschen Truppen in Oslo ein. Das erste Platzkonzert.
Was the work that Bletchley Park was able to do, limited as it was that able to make a difference?
Not really. I mean, one of the features of intelligence is you can have the best intelligence in the world, but if you don't have the military resources to act on that intelligence, then it's not going to help you very much. And that was definitely the case in the Norwegian campaign. There was no success with German naval Enigma, but as we've said before, German army and air force Enigma had been being broken since January of 1940. And indeed, the Germans set up a new network to cover the Norwegian campaign for the German air force. And this was codenamed Yellow at Bletchley. It went on the air from about the 10th of April, so a day or two after the invasion had begun, and carried on until mid-May. And Bletchley had actually broken it by 15th of April and were able to read it more or less every day. That was great, but part of the problem was, firstly, there weren't the resources on the battlefield to do much about it. But secondly, at this point, Bletchley is quite new to breaking Enigma. And a lot of the arrangements that we take for granted later in the war for communicating those decrypts to commanders in the field or to the War Office or whoever hadn't really been set up yet. So they're reading these messages, but the channels by which they could be sent to the people who needed the information were not very well organized. Also, one of the problems with Enigma traffic is a lot of it is quite technical. It uses a lot of jargon, it uses a lot of abbreviations, everything else. And Bletchley was still in its early stages of understanding the content of these messages, whereas later in the war, they had a much better handle on what a lot of the complexities of Enigma messages actually meant, because they've been studying for a few years. At this point, they're still reading messages for the first time, so they're trying to get their head around what they say, even once they've been broken. The final problem is one of credibility, and this was because at this period, Bletchley was very keen to disguise the fact that they were reading German Enigma messages at all. So the traffic was passed on as if it was human intelligence, as if it was information garnered from a human spy. And at this period, the famous codename Boniface was being used to describe the fictional spy who was providing this intelligence. And that's all very well. It keeps the secret. But the problem is, we've already mentioned how the Admiralty, the War Office, the high-ups in London weren't necessarily very convinced by human intelligence, by rumours from spies and things. So it took a while for the credibility of the information to pick up, and also for the crucial people to be let into the secret of Enigma so that they could know that this was actually really good pucker SIGINT rather than just, you know, a rumour that someone's picked up in a bar.
For those that were read into the secret of Enigma, were they receiving the raw message text, or was it still in this sort of disguised manner as a sort of intelligence report via sort of hearsay?
A very few people, particularly in the Admiralty, were getting the pretty much plain text. It was obviously edited a little bit to interpret it and to make sense of what it was saying. And typically, from the point of view of the Navy, that information would be sent to the Admiralty, and then people of flag officer rank, so admirals at sea, were indoctrinated, and the messages were also sent to them under a particular, more secure code. So it was possible that some commanders at sea were getting the information, but the land commanders were basically not. Very few of the generals in Norway knew about Ultra or were getting the information. So it's really not making its way through the system. The contrast to this, ironically, is the Germans, who the German Navy's SIGINT organization, the Bay-Dienst as it was called, had broken Royal Navy codes quite effectively by this period, and is estimated that something like 30% of the traffic that was going to Royal Navy ships at sea was being intercepted by the Germans.
When you say intercepted, do you mean intercepted and read?
Intercepted and read, yes. Yes, they understood the code sufficiently that they could read those messages. We tend to think of the balance of SIGINT favouring the Allies in World War II because of the later success of Bletchley. But it's probably arguable that at this period, the people who are really succeeding at this game are the Germans rather than the British.
Out of interest, when you said that a lot of the German Navy messages, about 90%, I think you said, were enciphered with Enigma, how were the Royal Navy encrypting their messages? Were they using mechanical encryption as well?
They weren't. They were using additive book codes. And these are these codes where you have basically a dictionary of all the things you might want to say. And each word or phrase has a number allocated to it, a 4 or 5 digit number. And you compose your message out of those numbers. And then you have a book of random numbers in similar sized groups, in 4 or 5 letter groups. And basically, you then add the two sets of numbers together, and that gives you your code. This was quite commonly used. The Germans had systems like this before they introduced Enigma. The Italians were using systems like this. The Japanese were using systems like this. So it's a very common form of naval communication. But it's also breakable if you put enough work in. And the Germans, by 1940, had put that work in and were able to read not all of, but a significant proportion of Royal Navy traffic. And they were able to do that right up until 1943, in fact. It was only when some of these early code books were actually phased out and replaced that the Germans were shut out of the traffic.
What did Bletchley Park think of this difficulty in communicating the intelligence that they were learning from the sources that they were able to have access to?
The impression you get is there was a lot of frustration in naval section. Harry Hinsley had the opportunity to express his opinion when he wrote his official history of the campaign as part of his History of British Intelligence, and he doesn't hold back. At one point, he makes the rather succinct remark, "At the outset of the campaign, the Admiralty's own ignorance was complete." And I think that's partly his historian's assessment of the situation, but that's also partly his frustration as a 21-year-old Bletchleyite coming through it as well.
23rd of October, 1940. The only conclusion is that they not only duplicate our work and other people's work, but duplicate it in so aimless and inefficient a manner that all their time is taken up in groping at the truth and putting as much of it as is obvious to all on card indexes. If they duplicated in the right spirit, and with some purpose, they would be able to answer questions properly, and also possibly to contribute to general advancement. One reason that prevented them from doing this appeared to be a competitive spirit, which, instead of being of a healthy type, is obviously personal, and couched itself in a show of independence and an air of obstruction. It appeared to be based on personal opposition to Bletchley Park. It was increased by the fact that the presence of one person from BP appeared to them to remove all their raison d'être. They felt themselves cut out. Apart from the above, I suspect that another reason for their inadequacy is incapacity, pure and simple. They know facts, but they seem to have no general grasp of these facts in association. They lack imagination. They cannot utilize the knowledge they so busily compile. Harry Hinsley.
Can you give us any examples of the effects, how this frustration could be seen in what was occurring on the front line?
Well, there is a rather notorious example which came from the very end of the campaign. As I was describing, the Allied forces were evacuated by sea first week of June. And as part of that operation, one of Britain's aircraft carriers, HMS Glorious, was sent to the Norwegian coast. She'd actually gone across to deliver aircraft that could be flown off the aircraft carrier and landed on runways in Norway. And the idea was that she would sail out again and those aircraft could fly back onto the aircraft carrier and be brought back to the UK. The problem was that the German Navy knew all about this. The Bay-Dienst had read the messages describing the operation and they knew pretty much exactly where Glorious was. And they sent two of their larger battlecruisers, Scharnhorst and Gneisenau, up to the Norwegian coast to disrupt the evacuation. They left Kiel on the 4th of June, which is when the evacuation was basically getting going. Hinsley, meanwhile, was still mapping the traffic of all of these various units, and he was able to identify that big German ship, sort of described as heavy units in the technical jargon. These big ships were moving towards Norway, and he was very concerned that this reflected the fact that the evacuation forces were going to get attacked. And again, he passed this information on to the Admiralty, but unfortunately, again, they didn't act on it. You have a slightly weird situation that the Admiralty was so absorbed with organising the evacuation that it hadn't told anybody else it was going on. So GCNCS at Bletchley Park didn't realise an evacuation was in progress. And even RAF Coastal Command, who you think would be providing aircraft cover for the evacuation, hadn't been told either. So there's a bit of a kind of left-hand, right-hand situation happening at this point.
You say that it's because they were so absorbed in that task. Is it possible that they just didn't think the codebreakers needed to know or that GCNCS needed to have this information? If they're busy deciphering, then perhaps they don't need to know operational information.
I think that's the case, yes. It's this idea that GCNCS is a decoding organisation, a cryptological organisation that you consult when you need it, but it doesn't need to be kept fully in the picture day to day, because that's not necessarily considered to be their role. Actually, the reverse was true, that Bletchley really needed to know what was happening everywhere in order to inform its work, and also to be able to identify when it had found things that would directly impact on ongoing operations. Because obviously, if they'd known that all of these ships were there and vulnerable, you know, you've got merchant ships full of soldiers and everything else, then they might have banged their drum a bit harder. But it's part of this thing that we've already covered, that intelligence just wasn't being incorporated into the decision-making cycle effectively enough at this stage of the war.
What about the Germans? What was their intelligence like?
Well, as I say, they had a very clear picture of where various Royal Naval units were, and they knew in particular where Glorious was. And sadly, they were able to sail towards her and attack and sink the Glorious in very short order. Again, a number of mistakes contributed to this. The aircraft carrier was busy landing on these aircraft that were flying out of Norway, so they were kind of absorbed with that operation. Normally an aircraft carrier, if there's any chance it's going to be attacked, you put up a CAP, as it's called, a combat air patrol. You have aircraft in the air circling your aircraft carrier, making sure that nobody's going to attack it, because they can obviously see further. But Glorious had no cap up and was really, again, kind of rather self-absorbed, worrying about getting all these aircraft on board. And the first thing they know is when Scharnhorst and Deisenau literally appear over the horizon at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon on the 8th of June. And they sent off a hurried wireless message saying that they'd seen these two ships only 15 miles away, which is pretty close in naval terms. And very shortly after, German shells started landing on the aircraft carrier. The sad irony is that Glorious was sunk. Her two escorting destroyers, Acasta and Ardent, were also sunk. And that was all over by sort of early evening. The message that Glorious had sent out reporting the sighting of the German ships was only ever picked up by the Germans. Nobody on the Allied side ever received that message. And the first the Allies knew about the sinking of the Glorious was when the Germans reported it on the news the following day.
Das Oberkommando der Wehrmacht gab am 9. Juni bekannt. Deutsche Seestreitkräfte, darunter die beiden Schlachtschiffe Gneisenau und Scharnhorst, operierten unter Führung des Admirals Marschall im Nordmeer. Hierbei wurden verschiedene englische Einheiten vernichtet. Die Schlachtschiffe Gneisenau und Scharnhorst folgen einander in Kiellinie. Mit 26.000 Tonnen sind sie zurzeit unsere stärksten Schiffe. Je 9 28 cm Geschütze auf Drillingstürme verteilt sind ihre wirkungsvollsten Waffen. Inzwischen ist der englische Flugzeugträger Glorious gemeldet. Der 22.500 Tonnen große Koloss hat 48 Bombenflugzeuge an Bord. Mit äußerster Kraft geht es dem Feind entgegen, der durch Zerstörer gesichert wird. Die wertvolle Beute ist erkannt. Unsere Schlachtschiffe eröffnen das Feuer auf die Glorious.
What were the consequences for naval intelligence and for GCNCS?
Well, once it was appreciated that the Glorious had been sunk, that was obviously something of a scandal in the UK. It was by no means the Royal Navy's finest hour. Questions were actually asked in Parliament about how this could have been allowed to happen, because still in 1940, there was the perception that the Royal Navy ruled the waves and, you know, our ships shouldn't be getting sunk at all, let alone with this sort of regularity. There were a variety of kind of post-mortems into the Norwegian campaign. Perhaps most significantly from the Bletchley Park point of view, it did finally mean that GCNCS and the Naval Intelligence Directorate, the OIC, kind of got together and figured out how to do things better. Ned Denning, who ran the OIC, and his boss, Jock Clayton, actually met Harry Hinsley for the first time, and the meetings were conducted between them and Birch, and a lot of the misunderstandings and kind of territorial arguments that had existed between naval section at Bletchley and naval intelligence at the Admiralty were sorted out, because it became obvious to everybody that this was no way to carry on and they both needed each other. This is the point where Bletchley was actually allowed to get on with all of its work, because the various activities that naval intelligence had previously considered to be non-cryptographic or not cryptographic enough, shall we say, and thus had to be done at the Admiralty, they said, okay, we'll let Bletchley do those things because they naturally sit with their intelligence work. And a number of the staff who'd previously been in London came back to Bletchley, but also some of the people at Bletchley went on liaison visits to the Admiralty in London, and the relationship became a lot better as a consequence. One of the results of this is that Hinsley's reputation at the Admiralty and indeed his seniority at Bletchley rises as a consequence. And he went on to be the rather amorphously titled Intelligence Staff Officer of Naval Section, which basically is a title that means he can do whatever he wants. And he becomes a kind of roving expert for Naval Section and is able to contribute to naval operations for the rest of the war.
Do you think that was as a result of what he had been through in this situation? Or is that, do you think, because he was showing aptitude and being able to take on these levels of responsibility at working at that level?
I think it was aptitude. I think people spotted that he had been very well chosen at St. John's College and that he was the man for the job. And as a result, you know, he was supported by his seniors at Bletchley and he was respected by the people at the Admiralty. And that kind of goes to the Bletchley Park story more widely, because there are a number of people who come in very young, but once it's been recognised that they're good at what they do, their talent is recognised and they're given free rein to get on with it, so to speak. Hinsley is quite a good example because some of the other people we tend to think of are the likes of Tutte or Turing, who are specifically cryptographers. But Hinsley's specialism wasn't so much cryptography as the wider intelligence analysis liaison, kind of seeing the big picture role. That's where his strengths lay, and that's what he went on to do. A measure of the respect that was accorded to Harry Hinsley and his seniority at Bletchley by the end of the war was that he was appointed chairman of an outfit called TICOM, who were the body that went to Germany in 1945 to round up all the German cryptographers and other SIGINT specialists as Germany was surrendering. The other thing that happened to Harry Hinsley at Bletchley, of course, was he met his future wife, Hilary Brett Smith, who worked with him in Naval Section.
What were the strategic consequences, would you say, of Germany's successful invasion of Norway?
Well, Norway continues to be a big interest for the Allies and kind of almost a battlefield for the rest of the war. Of course, the Germans continue to get their iron ore, which was their strategic purpose in the first place. Those ships continue to sail from Narvik and iron ore continues to flow to Germany. But more importantly, the Norwegian coast becomes a stepping stone for U-boats heading out into the Atlantic. And of course, in the summer of 1941, once the Germans have invaded Russia, supply convoys from Western Allies to the Russians are going round the North Cape and through the Arctic Ocean. And so northern Norway becomes a key part of that campaign because the Germans are able to base surface ships, submarines and aircraft in northern Norway above the Arctic Circle. And a very fierce war is fought up there with the Allies trying to push convoys through to Murmansk and Archangel and the Germans trying to interrupt them. Also, the fjords become home for the last of the bigger units of the German Navy. And the battleship Tirpitz, although it never actually sails to fight the Royal Navy directly, it lurks in the fjords right up until 1944 and is a major thorn in the side of the Allies for all of those years. Hitler, at the same time, having conquered Norway, he decided that it was very vulnerable and he was convinced that the Allies were going to try and take it back off him. And indeed, one of the deception operations that's created around D-Day is Fortitude North, which is the idea that the Germans could be persuaded that an invasion of Norway might happen as well as an invasion of France. And although the deception wasn't particularly effective, it's not a crazy idea because Hitler is no doubt worried about what will happen to Norway. In the event, of course, no further land fighting happens and the German forces surrender in place in Norway after they've been beaten in Western Europe. But of course, nobody knows that up to that point. From Bletchley Park's point of view, I think the Norwegian campaign stands out because it makes plain a lot of the problems, systematic problems that existed with Bletchley Park and its various customers and the organisation of intelligence at the outbreak of the war. And it takes something like the shock of the Norwegian campaign for GCNCS and British intelligence to really get its act together. That point, I think, is best expressed by Harry Hinsley himself, and we're very lucky to have a recording of him, so I think we should leave the last word on that to him.
Well, they were, of course, very standoffish to begin with. It took quite a long time, and one or two, well, perhaps I could say disasters, before you got their respect. They had no more idea of the need for meticulousness in studying this kind of thing than fly. So they couldn't see what we were beginning to be able to see from it. And first we had commotion before the Germans went to Norway, on which I was able to say, look, there is commotion. I don't know what it is, but they didn't take any notice. They didn't take any notice of a lot of other information either before Norway. But then, more seriously, I did give them warning from this external study that big ships were leaving the Baltic, or were preparing to. And I pressed them a bit, and they wouldn't send a signal out. And then, of course, the Scharnhorst and the Gneisenau, two battle cruisers, sank one of our aircraft carriers, the Glorious, without any warning at all. But they quickly turned their cheek after that.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.